tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Welcome to This Miraculous Life on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Sarah Oliveri Olumba, and today we have a letter from somebody who calls themselves Alone and Lonely. So are you ready to hear from Alone and Lonely? Alexia, we have Alexia, our engineer here.
Yeah, I'm ready. Let's hear it.
All right, here we go. Dear Sarah, a while back, I realized that I was lonely, which is strange, because for a long time, the last thing I wanted was a partner. My last relationship ended with bitterness and heartbreak, and in the years since, I suppose I have shunned romance and remained focused on my career. If I'm not busy with work, I'm at rock climbing, attending book club, or hanging out with friends on the weekend. I rarely have periods of time when I'm just on my own. Rarely, but I do. And about a year ago, I had one of those times. I had completed all my work tasks. There were no social obligations. And I would say, I felt relatively relaxed. I started making a list of things I'd like to do if I had more free time to myself. As I did so, it suddenly occurred to me, am I going to be doing all of these things alone? Since that little question crept into my head, I have felt increasingly lonely. When I have free time now, I can't help but think it would be nice to have someone to spend it with. Someone to chat with about how the weekend went, to make jokes with, someone to make plans with, and yes, someone to be intimate with. I now notice happy couples everywhere, not least in my own friend circle. In fact, I am one of the few singles left in my group. I consider myself a social person. I think I have a fair number of friends. I go out to different social events from time to time. Why can't I meet someone? I used to just laugh when grandma would ask, when are you going to bring someone home for us to meet? And now I'm asking myself the same question. Am I just undesirable? Did I forget how to flirt or be romantically available? Why did this feeling of loneliness just strike me one day and continue to grow? Should I continue this tiring search to find a partner? Or should I find a way back to being alone but not lonely? Anticipating your thoughts, Alone and Lonely. Wow, thanks for writing us, Alone and Lonely. I know that this is something that a lot of people, not just you, have on their mind. So I'm really thankful that you wrote us this letter and opened up to us. Alexia, do you have any immediate reactions to Alone and Lonely's note to us?
I've been wrestling with this concept a lot with my friends, I think. Not just feeling lonely in the sense of like I'd like a romantic partner, but just lonely in general. What does it mean to enjoy the time that you have by yourself versus like feeling like something's missing or that time feels incomplete? So yeah, I'm interested to see what you have for our writer today.
Yeah. Right. So you're saying it's not just that you want a romantic partner necessarily, but that you want to more enjoy your alone time. Absolutely. Okay. So Alone and Lonely. Again, thank you so much for writing us. So there's a number of things that I think are important to touch on in your letter. And I want to start with the one that I think is most important to sort of get out of the way first. And that is this: your desire to have a romantic partnership, I think, is natural. I think it is human. I think that most people have sort of an inherent urge to experience romantic partnership. So I want to say and acknowledge that, because I think that that's real, and I don't want the advice to encourage you to sort of lie to yourself or feel like you have to trick yourself into being happy with your current situation. But that being said, the first thing that I want to start with is the research on happiness versus being single. And there's something that I think is really interesting, which is that in the past, the psychological research has always indicated that married people are happier and healthier. But what's really interesting is that the research that's coming out now, the research that's coming out in like the past 10 years, actually tells a really different story. And it shows that the research that had been done on marriage and relationships in the past was very likely flawed, and that a lot of that research was done sort of with the intention of proving that marriage is a good thing. Does that make sense? So part of the challenge of any research is that the research can be biased, right? The researcher themselves can have an agenda and then even unknowingly design their studies or design their questions or even make their observations in a way that confirm their hypothesis, right? And instead of looking at the research in a way that's totally neutral so that they're seeing everything that's there such that there is a higher likelihood that their hypothesis may not be reinforced, right? So this is what the new psychological research is indicating, that actually people who are married are no happier post-marriage than they were when they were single. And I think that this is a very, very important finding. It's something that I'm passionate about, that I care about, and that I believe and that I find to be personally true in my own life. And I am married and I have a phenomenal marriage. I married a guy who I believe that it would be literally impossible to have found somebody who was a better fit for me than my husband. But what I will say is that I was happy when I met him, right? I felt really good about my life before I got married, and I feel good about my life still post-marriage. So one thing that the research is indicating is that the previous findings on marriage may have been false. And I think that this is important for people to know, because people look at that research and say, it's impossible for me to have a happy life if I don't have a lifelong partner. And what the research is now saying is that simply is not true. There's a great body of research by a researcher by the name of Dimitri Tuman. So he's been doing research on the effect of marriage, particularly on our health, but also on our happiness. And what his research indicates is that marriage actually does not have any effect on our health, and does not have effect on our happiness either. And that the only people in his research who showed some very small benefits from marriage were people who were very old, right? So people who were already elderly and their marriage had already lasted that long, and the benefit was to their physical health. Okay. So it was a very small population of people. And then what he also found is that single people were often happy and healthy. And a lot of whether they were happy or healthy related with how secure they were about being single. So this is research that I find essential to mention, because like I said, in the past, we have really told this narrative that you have to have a lifelong romantic partner in order to reach peak happiness levels. And what the research, which is being done in essentially a more nuanced way, right? They're looking at more factors. They're looking, in the past, often the research on marriage would focus, they would exclude anybody whose marriage ever ended from the research, right? Which is not really an accurate or honest way of doing the research, because what the research that all of us probably do know is that half of all marriages end in divorce. And so that's just simply a reality, that if we get married, there is a chance, technically speaking, a 50% chance that our marriage will not last. And so I find this research essential because it reveals a new finding, which is that it is scientifically proven that it is possible to be as happy and as healthy as anybody else on the face of the earth if you are single and if you do not have a romantic lifelong partner. That is now proven. And that to me is very liberating, because we don't always get to choose if and when we find our romantic partner. So that's the first thing that I want you to know in terms of the research, alone and lonely, is that the truth is that what the new psychological research is showing is that marriage and romantic partnership does not have the same effect on our happiness as what we had originally thought. Instead, what we're finding is that married people are technically no happier and measurably no happier than single people. And specifically, people who are married are no happier than they were before they got married. So maybe that first statement I made, that might have been a little bit off, because there is, I think, a bit of a discrepancy between the happiness level of people who are married and people who aren't. But what the research is now finding is that that happiness level is not accounted for by the marriage. That people who become married, the marriage does not make them happier. And in fact, the research is indicating that the marriage makes them a little bit less happy. So basically, there's one study, I forgot who did it, but if you Google it, I'm sure you'll find it. There's one study that shows that people are, they're happy, they have one happiness level before they get married, and then they get married and their happiness goes up, right? Their happiness goes up a little bit right after they get married. And then after that, after the initial rise, sort of during the newlywed phase, their happiness goes down, and it goes down to below the level that it was at prior to the marriage, okay? So bottom line is that getting married is not the key to happiness, and the research is now proving that. There is one thing in there that I think is interesting and which may explain some of the flawed research in the past, which is that it may be true that people who are married are happier than people who are not married on average. But based on the research that they were happier before they got married than after they got married, what that indicates is simply that people who tend to rate as happier, whether single or married, are more likely to get married, okay? But that is not across the board. It's not like every single person is just a less happy person, right? And you can, because what we now know clearly from the research is that the happiness is not a result of the marriage, that means that every single person can take ownership over their ability to manifest and sort of manipulate their own happiness. So let me take a pause and see if Alexia in the studio is picking up what I'm sharing about this sort of new research and some of the confounding factors that I think in the past confused people about what the result of marriage is on our happiness and our health.
Yeah. I have heard a little bit about what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Thank you for saying it. It is very liberating. Right? And I also think a lot of those studies were taking place like way before we we're in this space in 2018 where we're like, is marriage even an institution that people want to participate in? And right. What else does it mean to be married in the institution of marriage and at least the United States? So saying something like that is very liberating. And I think that this is the first step of understanding, like, you can't actually be in control of your happiness. It's not contingent upon this box that you check of your marital status. Right. This is a great first point, I think, for our writer today to understand how that you have agency over your happiness.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Well put. I love the word agency. It's one of my favorites.
Me too.
Yeah, Alexia, and I love the idea about checking a box, you know, because I think that in our mind, a lot of us have built up happiness to be a checklist. You know, I will be happy when I have a nice place to live. I have a romantic partner. I have enough money that I don't have to worry about money. So the truth is that happiness is not a checklist. Happiness is a feeling. You know, happiness is a state of mind. I know for a fact, and I was talking about this statement with my nephew. He's 8 years old. This past weekend, he said that he knows for a fact that tattoos cause cancer. And we were like, let's talk about what it means to know something for a fact. And so I have no idea who told him that. It was not us. But anyways, what we came up with is that if you know something for a fact, that means I have seen it with my own two eyes. I have literally witnessed that this is a truth. Okay. So that being said, I know for a fact that it is possible to be happy and have zero things on the checklist met, to have no romantic partner, to have no money, to have even, for goodness sakes, no job, and still be happy. That is a fact that I'm aware of because I have seen people do it. I've seen people who have some pennies in their pocket, their family members have passed away, right? This is real. This is a true story. There's this person that I met. He had pennies in his pocket. His family members had passed away. He'd lost his job and he was celebrating life, right? He was talking about how blessed he was. He was talking about all of this stuff happened to me and not a day has gone by when I haven't had anything to eat and when I haven't had a roof over my head. And he was smiling and he was praising. He was happy. He was happier than anybody else who I saw around me. And it was clear from his life story that he had less. Okay. So, and you know, even in my own life, I have seen that when I have more security or when I have more money, even like I said, I love my marriage. It adds a great deal of meaning, a lot of learning to my life. But the truth is that I felt that my life was meaningful and full and satisfying before I got married. Okay. So I know for a fact that we don't have to meet this checklist in order to be happy. The checklist rather is more like a plan for a party or something like that. It's like a specific vision that it would be, the way I would put it, it would satisfy our ego a great deal. It would feel good to meet all of those boxes on the checklist. And don't get me wrong, that would indeed feel good. And it may feel good for a little while. It may feel good for a long while. In general, the psychological research indicates that most of the checked boxes, whether it's a goal, a personal goal, even a goal that really took a lot of effort to achieve, an amount of money, a size of house, even a house period, etc., that when we check those boxes, it feels good for a little while, just like the marriage. There is a temporary boost to our happiness. But then, as soon as the novelty wears off, we essentially go right back to our baseline. We go right back to what psychologists call our quote unquote set point, which is our general level of individual happiness. So our set point for happiness is essentially the same thing as body weight. You know how we talk about body weight, and most people have a quote unquote set point where, you know, sometimes they're 5 or 10 pounds more than this. Sometimes they're 5 or 10 pounds less. But in general, whether they're putting a little effort or a lot of effort, this is where their body weight tends to come back to. Okay. That's their set point. Same thing for happiness. So this is the third thing, alone and lonely, is that your happiness is not dependent on a checklist. You can achieve happiness and, more importantly, feel happy regardless of the boxes in your life that are checked. That's known, right? That's known fact. And what we also know is that checking the boxes does provide a temporary boost to happiness, but that boost is indeed only temporary. And so the fourth thing that I want to say is, okay, so if all of that is true, if getting married doesn't make you happier, if checking the boxes doesn't make you happier, then what the fuck is going to make you happier? I've given a lot of information today about what does not make you happier. And what makes us happier is mindset. Okay, number one. And then number two, actually, relationships do make us happier. It's just that it's not limited to a romantic relationship. Okay, so the science does show both of those things to be true. So let's talk about mindset for a little while. The good news is that Dr. Martin Seligman, my professor of positive psychology, did research to try and understand this concept of the happiness set point. In other words, like I said, that general spot where you as an individual, your happiness tends to hover. You know, if you're working really hard at it, or if you do get a promotion, right, your happiness might go up. Or if you do get married, your happiness might go up for a little bit. And then if your toe gets run over by a car. I don't know why that's what I thought of, but that's what I thought of. If your toe gets run over by a car, then your happiness goes down a little bit below your set point. But in general, you tend to come back to the same spot. And people do indeed have different set points. So my set point might be lower or higher than the person next to me, which means in general, I am inclined without much effort to be a little bit happier or a little bit less happy than somebody else. But here's the great news. The research shows that you can raise your set point. Okay. So in other words, you can do purposeful activities of the mind and in your life that will raise your happiness, not in a temporary way, but in a lasting way. And the meaning of that is that you would change your actual set point. So in other words, through doing these conscious exercises, you would become a new sort of tier of happiness. So throughout those fluctuations, your happiness would remain one step above what it originally was. And the way that you can do that is through conscious effort, and specifically conscious effort as it relates to your mindset. So let's take a quick break. And when we come back from the break, I am going to tell you what some of those conscious efforts that you might make to increase your set point and lastingly increase your happiness might be. We'll be right back.
You're tuned in. You're listening to This Miraculous Life on Full Service Radio.
Welcome back. Today we are hearing from Alone and Lonely, who is wondering whether to continue the, as they call it, tiring search for a romantic partner, or whether to try and get back to being alone but not lonely, as they put it. And so, as you may be seeing from my points so far, I would indeed tend towards the get back to being alone but not lonely. And so what I've shared so far is, number one, alone and lonely, this urge that you have to find a romantic partner, I think, is natural. And I don't think that there's any need to beat yourself up about that or make it go away. But the second two points are that you should also know that in spite of this urge, finding a romantic partner does not make you happier. Okay, so even if you feel lonely now, what you should know is that this desire shouldn't be about saying, oh, this is what's going to make me happier, or this is what's going to increase my life happiness. Because the research indicates, and especially the research that is coming out most recently, that actually getting married does not make us happier. In fact, it often makes us just a teeny bit less happy. I'm sure there are other benefits, but getting married is most definitely not a requisite to happiness, okay? It's not an essential ingredient. So it's important to know that going in so that you can own your ability to be just as happy now as you would with a partner. And that being said, that doesn't mean that it's not still an experience that you would like to have. And then the third point was that checking the boxes on a checklist also is not the route to happiness, whether that be marriage or a promotion or a certain amount of money or buying a house or any of that stuff. Rather, the only route that we've found to lastingly increase our quote-unquote happiness set point is a shift in mindset. And then the other thing that I'm going to get into next is that, yes, relationships do also have a lasting impact on our happiness. But when I say relationships, and when the research says relationships, that is not limited to a romantic relationship. So it is true that people who feel like they have not only no romantic partner, but also no friends and family are less happy. Okay. But it is not true that people who have no romantic partner, but report that they have strong friendships and family, those people are not less happy than the people who are married. So, increasing your happiness set point, shifting your mindset. How do we do this? We found out in an earlier episode, the episode was called Comfortably Miserable. We learned about optimism. And optimism is certainly my personal favorite tool for increasing happiness, and specifically shifting our mindset and the way in which we are interpreting the information available to us in our world. And during the episode Comfortably Miserable, we learned about how optimism is a tool that can allow us to take risks, and that risk-taking also is an essential ingredient to happiness, because it allows us to create and try things that are ultimately very meaningful and satisfying for us. And optimism allows us access to risk-taking because of the way that we explain setbacks to ourselves through the lens of optimism, which makes those risks not so risky. But there's another side of optimism that I want to share with you today. And the other half of optimism is, how do we interpret the good things that happen in our life? Okay. And so what we learned during Comfortably Miserable is that there are three components to optimism. The three components are permanence, pervasiveness, and personalization. And so what that means is that the psychological definition of optimism is that the optimist interprets bad things that happen in their life or setbacks, failures, as not permanent. It's not going to last forever. Not pervasive. It's not going to ruin everything. And not personal. And again, we talked about that in the episode Comfortably Miserable. And that interpretation of bad things allows the optimist to keep on going, to not get stuck, to not have a failure or a disappointment or even a great pain in life destroy and paralyze them. But the other side of optimism, which we are going to learn about today, is when the optimist experiences something good, they explain it in those three realms in the exact opposite way. And so the optimist, when something good happens to them, they explain it and interpret the information to mean this good thing is going to be permanent. In other words, I have no reason to doubt that this good thing is going to last. Make sense? So you know how some people are always kind of waiting for the other shoe to drop? They're like, oh yeah, it's good now, but it won't last. Okay, the optimist does not do that. The optimist is like, oh yeah, this good thing happened, and so I presume that this good thing will continue. makes sense. And it's often not something that they're consciously thinking about. It's just that they're not doubting that the good thing will last. Secondly, the optimist allows the good thing to pervade in their life. This is one that is actually hard for most people to do. And this means when something good happens in the life of the optimist, they celebrate it. They talk about it. They let it improve their day. They let it brighten them up. It's not just a checked box where they say, okay, that went well. Now moving on to the problems that I need to fix. Okay, they actually spend some time savoring the things that go well. And in turn, that good thing has an overarching positive effect in their life. It has a ripple effect. Okay, so pervasiveness. And then thirdly, personalization. The optimist takes some credit for things that go well in their life. And that doesn't mean that they don't give credit where credit is due. That doesn't mean that they don't give thanks when they experience a blessing or great fortune, but it means that they are consciously aware of their own ability to affect and manifest good in their life. So for instance, if the optimist gets a promotion, they might be thankful for their great team, right? Or their great manager or their manager going to bat for them. All those things are legitimate, but they would also be aware of their own contribution. They would also say to themselves, yeah, I have been working really hard. And I advocated for myself to get this promotion, or I made it known that I was interested in advancing, or I took on an extra project, whatever the case may be. But the non-optimist might say to themselves, oh, well, it's just because I have such a great team supporting me. I just got lucky. Or, oh, well, it's just because I happened to be placed on this project that was high profile. So the people at the top were able to notice me. Okay, so you see how they're externalizing the positive thing. So that is one specific route to a mindset shift. And then from a mindset shift to an increase in our happiness set point. So I'm going to give you guys a couple of questions that can allow you to actually tap into this science on a day-to-day basis. What I've found through my coaching practice is that simply telling people what optimism is not enough, and that it's very difficult for us, even me, to say, oh, okay, so optimism means describing good things as permanent, pervasive, and personal. I'm going to do that now. No, our brain doesn't quite work that way. So what I've designed is a series of questions that can allow you to prompt your brain to think about how it could be permanent, pervasive, and personal. Okay. So for example, you can simply ask yourself, what's something that went well this week? You know, or what's something that went well in my life recently? And then you can ask yourself, how could it be permanent? Okay. So if it's not already in your mind, you can think about how can it be permanent? Maybe it means just keep doing what I'm doing. Maybe it means repeating a behavior that contributed to this result. Maybe it means saying thank you to a friend. Maybe it means showing up in the same spot the following week. Okay, so how could this be permanent? And then you can ask yourself, how did I contribute to this thing going well? Okay, how did you contribute to this thing going well in your life? And you may be tempted to come up with some ways that other people, places, things, deities, entities contributed. That's fine, but I want you to make sure that you come up with at least some ways that you contributed. And maybe it's simply saying yes to something, right? Maybe it's reaching out to somebody. Maybe it's an effort. And surely, yeah, there might have been other contributors. But I want you to make sure you answer that question about how did I contribute to this thing going well? Okay. And again, it could be as simple as saying yes or showing up. And then lastly, how could this good thing have a positive effect on other parts of my life? Okay. In other words, how could this thing ripple positively into other parts of my life? So for example, if you did get a promotion at work, you could say something about how this will affect positively your stress about money, right? Or you could say something about how this will positively affect your actual relationships with your coworkers because you're feeling more appreciated. So again, you want to ask yourself, how could this good thing have a positive effect in other parts of my life beyond just the one little area where the good thing happened? Alexia, are these questions making sense? Do these seem like something that you could use effectively?
They make a ton of sense. Yes, those are great frameworks. And I did have a question for you.
Yeah, please.
So I'm thinking about this again from the perspective of our writer. All of this talk about optimism is great. And then I feel like we even started the show talking in a way that would assume it's okay to be alone and you can sit in that. So how does this conversation about optimism, and I'm thinking about the last part of their letter, they were saying the search for a partner is very exhausting, or like, should I even continue this search? So how does that concept of optimism fare for our writer if they do decide that actively seeking a partner is something that they want to go ahead and go do after listening to this?
Right. Absolutely. Great question. And thanks for bringing it back. So, okay. A couple of things. Number one, I think that simply adopting an optimistic mindset can lastingly increase the overall happiness of alone and lonely. So that is the first point, regardless of whether they decide to continue the search for a partner or not. Secondly, the side of optimism where we explain disappointments, I think, is also highly relevant to alone and lonely. Should they continue the search? Should they continue dating? Because the truth is that dating is full of disappointments. Until you find the person that you decide, yes, I want to be with this person, then there are disappointments coming, right? And so on the other side of optimism, explaining the setbacks or the disappointments or things not going the way that you wanted, it's important that alone and lonely be able to tap into that other side of optimism where they're able to explain those quote unquote letdowns, or, you know, any date that doesn't result in finding someone that they really like, or even finding someone they really like and that person not being so into them, right? So all of these are setbacks or disappointments we experience along the way of dating. It's important that alone and lonely be able to explain those setbacks as not permanent, this is not going to last forever. Every person that I meet is not going to be somebody either who I don't like or who doesn't like me. Okay. This is not pervasive. Okay. So this is super important. And I think relates with the way that you described how you're feeling alone and lonely, which is that you want to be able to, even if you are experiencing setbacks or disappointments in the dating realm, to be able to look around and find the other things in your life that are going well and put stock into those things. And in writing your letter, Alone and Lonely, you talk about all the other things you do. You talk about being a social person. You talk about going rock climbing. You talk about book club. But the way that it's worded in your letter, you seem to be sort of diminishing those things. And I would really encourage you to spotlight those things and look at some of the things that are happening in your personal life outside of dating as things that are really significant and that in the end are significant contributors to anyone's happiness, period, whether they're in a relationship or not. And so don't fall into the trap of just because you're hoping to find a partner, diminishing those other things in your life that people who have partners are focused on not going well in their life. Do you see what I mean? So not seeing the dating disappointments as permanent, perhaps even more importantly, not seeing them as pervasive, and then lastly, not seeing them as personal. So each time you go on a date that doesn't work out or have a dating experience that doesn't work out, you can't blame yourself, you know? If there are certain factors that you identify that you want to change or improve, etc., that's fine, but you also have to be diligent about looking at the factors outside of your control. And every time a relationship doesn't work out, not taking it personally, whether it's because you didn't like the person or because the person didn't like you. You have to find a way to not take it personally. Does that answer your question a little bit, Alexia?
Definitely. Yeah. Thanks, Sarah.
Yeah, of course. Great question. So alone and lonely, what this means is that if you are going to continue dating, I encourage you to apply the lens of optimism to help thrive through the setbacks and the disappointments. And then regardless, I think you would be well served to apply the lens of optimism for the good things in your life in order that those things can affect you positively and uplift you a bit further. So the last thing that I want to say is regarding your question, should I continue the tiring search to find a partner? And what I want to say, alone and lonely, is that so long as it feels tiring, I think that you should take a break. Okay? So this is my thought. I was thinking about this yesterday as I was walking around my day, thinking through your letter, Alone and Lonely. I think that waiting to feel happy until we find a romantic partner, this is my personal opinion. Waiting to feel happy until we find a romantic partner is like waiting to feel happy until we win the lottery. And to me, it's a dangerous place to be because it means that we dump a lot of energy and resources and time into something that we have no way of controlling the outcome. And so I'm not saying to you, don't date, but what I'm saying to you is that if you are dating from the perspective of feeling that you must meet your partner before you can be happy, then I don't see any way that the dating is not going to feel exhausting. Do you see what I mean? Alexia, do you see what I mean?
Girl, yes. Keep going.
So alone and lonely, I think that so long as you have a lot of eggs in this basket and feel that you must get the outcome that you want as it relates to dating. I don't see any way for the dating to not feel exhausting. I think it is only when you begin to acknowledge that, yes, you desire to have a partnership. As we said in the beginning, and that's what I wanted to loop back around to, that is a natural desire. You know, I don't think that there's very many people who would say, because it is a thing that is available to experience in this human life, I never want to feel intimately and deeply connected with another being, with another soul. Yes, that is a totally valid, natural, authentic desire. And so I think it's good for you to be connected with that desire and be honest with yourself about that desire. But just because we have a desire doesn't mean that we can't be happy with what we already have, right? I'm trying to think of a good example. Like, I know a lot of people who have experienced profound spiritual revelations, right? They've experienced God talking to them, or they've literally seen God. Okay. I know a number of people who would say that that is a true experience for them. I would like to have that experience. I desire that experience, knowing that that is an experience that is available to human beings and that I am a spiritual human being. I would love to have that. But, and actually for a little while, I was jealous of people who have had that. But what I now understand is that I can have that desire, but I can also appreciate exactly what I already have, you know? And the truth is, I have not seen God, okay? I would like to say that I have, but I haven't. And I still feel that I have a close spiritual relationship with God. And I have an amazing, awesome, awe-inspiring life, okay? But there was a little while there when I felt that because I had not seen God, my life was less awe-inspiring. And so that's what I want you to know about your desire to have this close, deep, intimate relationship. That yes, it is totally legitimate for you to desire and crave that, but not having that does not make your life less awe-inspiring or less capable of making you feel happy and fulfilled. And so if you are going to continue on the dating experience, I think it's important to get to a place where you feel like, I'm doing this because I would like to have this experience, you know, not I'm doing this because I need to have this experience in order to be okay. Do you see the difference? Alexia, do you see the difference?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Cool. So I think that's the number one thing as it relates to whether or not to continue dating alone and lonely. And it, you know, if you're not there yet, then that's okay. And know that most people have to have a moment in their dating experience, if it's taking them some time to meet the person that they want to be with, to sort of take a break and get to that place. You know, get to that place where they reinvest in their self and their happiness as an individual. And you can do that through some of the tools that we talked about today, the optimism about good things, you know, acknowledging all of the other components of happiness that you have going in your life. And as it relates with that point about relationships do indeed increase happiness, you can reinvest and re-notice all of the other fulfilling, nourishing relationships that you have in your life. You know, there's a great piece of research about the oldest living society. One of the oldest living societies are the Okinawans in Japan. And the research finds that one of the number one contributors to why these people live so long is because they have close, lifelong friend groups. And specifically the women, they have these groups of female friends that they meet with and talk with on a daily basis for their entire lives. And they're friends with these people long after their husbands have passed away, if they had a husband, okay? So you can reinvest in your friend groups. So let's summarize our takeaways for Alone and Lonely. Number one, it's totally natural and healthy to desire romantic partnership. Number two, but the research is now indicating that there is no link between marriage and happiness. People who are married are no happier than they were when they are single, and single people are often just as happy as married people. In fact, people's happiness eventually declines slightly to below its original height for people who go from single to married. Okay. Number three, the only ways to lastingly increase your happiness are to change your mindset, which increases your happiness set point, and to have close relationships. And those close relationships are not limited to romance. The way that we learn to shift your mindset is to tap into optimism, specifically optimism, not just about the setbacks and disappointments, but about the good things. And then lastly, alone and lonely, if you feel that you must find a romantic partner in order to be happy, I see no way for the dating to not be exhausting. And therefore, if that's the case, I do think that you should take a break. But if in listening to this, you can sort of remind yourself and return home to that part of you that once felt happy, even when you were alone, and even now with the desire for romance in mind, which you stated that at one point you didn't even have the desire. Now you have the desire. Cool. But what I would like for you, what I would hope for you, is to be able to hold space for your heart in desire, hold space in your heart for desire, but still be happy prior to that desire being met. Desire is a fact of life. Just because we have a desire doesn't mean that we can't be happy in the present. Okay? So, alone and lonely, I hope that this is useful, any one of those 5 points to you. And what I also hope for all of us listening is that we are able to use these tools to see our life as it is now, as flawed, as empty in certain areas, as messy as it may be, as what it truly is, which is an incredible, precious, awe-inspiring gift. And that's where that optimism about good things come in. And if we can see that, then there's nothing that can steal our happiness away from us. And so if you attune to that, then date away. And I don't see any way for things to go wrong. Send us your letters as well. You guys listening, you can email me at sarah@thismiraculouslife.com. And I hope to be responding to one of you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.